You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In late August 2008, Bradley Crowder and David McKay, two Texas high school friends, told their parents that they were traveling to St. Paul, Minnesota to peacefully protest the Republican National Convention. So it came as quite a shock when the young men were arrested by the FBI with Molotov cocktails and crowd shields, part of a plot to disrupt the convention. Just how Crowder and McKay stopped being kids who wanted to make a difference and came to be labeled the terrorists known as the Texas Two is the subject of a new documentary called Better This World. It premieres a week from today at 10 p.m. as part of the PBS POV series. And I'm pleased to welcome filmmakers Kelly Duane de la Vega and Katie Galloway to our show today. Hi.
Hi, great to be here.
You both made documentaries on your own. How did you decide to collaborate on this one?
We actually grew up together in Berkeley, California, and went to the same high school, and then both moved to New York and had independently become filmmakers.
And now you're back in Berkeley.
We are both back in Berkeley, bumped into each other and found out about each other's filmmaking career, and there was just an instant creative chemistry between us. So we made the decision to explore working on a film together, and about 2 weeks later, we had found this one.
How soon after the events that happened at the convention did you begin filming?
You know, so the convention was in the beginning of September, and we began filming in January on the eve of David McKay's trial.
Now, where are Bradley Crowder and David McKay from?
Both of them are from Midland, Texas. Both were living in Austin at the time our story starts. They had both moved to Austin in their late teens, early 20s.
Now, Midland is associated with George W. Bush, isn't it? It's a fairly Republican city. Is it all that remarkable that these kids come out of that town?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty interesting in that, you know, they sort of say there's barely a Democratic Party in Midland, Texas, Bush's hometown. So they were sort of reared in a very conservative environment. But, you know, Brad Crowder in particular at a very young age sort of started to not identify with the general way of thinking in that town. So it is a pretty big departure from most of the people they grew up with.
Well, were their parents supportive of their activism? You include some telephone conversations that were recorded when they were in prison, and their parents come across as relatively non-judgmental, mostly giving parental advice.
Right. Well, they both parents had encouraged their kids in abstract ways to be active. So Brad's mother said, I always encouraged him to, you know, follow what he believed in. And David's dad said, I always encouraged him to stand up for people who were defenseless, the meek, the weak, the poor. And I think that once this happened, neither family certainly was sanguine about their having built Molotov cocktails. But they really, their parental mode and their love for their children and the children that they knew is what kicked in and an attempt to sort of protect them from what they were facing, which was some pretty grave potential consequences.
How old were they when they got involved in activism? Were they part of a larger community in Austin?
You know, so Bradley Crowder, when he was, I don't know, second or third grade, maybe, Katie, you know, fourth, found out that Nike used child labor. And at that age, he would make little billboards in Midland, Texas and stand on the side of the road. So in his own way, he was involved in activism from a pretty young age. But they were in their very early 20s when they decided to protest at the Republican National Convention. And prior to that, the only other sort of major event they had taken place in was a protest of the KKK through their hometown. They were not part of a large network in Austin. They knew some of the big players, and then they developed a relationship with a mentor that was a prominent and well-respected activist in the community.
So tell us about him, Brandon Darby. How did he meet Crowder and McKay?
Well, Crowder and McKay, when they went to an informational meeting in Austin about 8 months before the Republican National Convention, 7 months before. They were just really going to check it out. Brad was pretty interested in the possibility of going to protest the RNC. He didn't have a car. David gave him a ride. He might have otherwise not even been there. But they were going to a talk given by an anarchist collective out of the Twin Cities who were recruiting people to come and protest. They were called the Welcoming Committee. And there they met Brandon Darby, who was a radical activist, well-respected, as Kelly said, for his work after Hurricane Katrina. He had been one of the co-founders of a group called Common Ground with Scott Crow and former Black Panther Malik Rahim and others. And he had done an amazing work and had fed and housed thousands of people after Katrina. And Brad knew about him. And so when Brandon approached them and said, you know, I think we should talk about working together as a group leading up to the convention, they were, I guess the word might be pie-eyed to have an activist of such stature be interested in working with them.
Well, he comes across as a very charismatic figure. He's very good-looking, very manly looking, I guess, because he does seem to suggest that the kind of activism he was talking about is what separates the men from the boys. Were many young people drawn to him?
You know, I think he affected a lot of people, especially when he was in New Orleans, you know, some negatively, but many people were very inspired by the way he talked. Some were turned off by it because I think something he tapped into was it was sort of a machismo way. You know, his form of activism was sort of stand up, be a man, and, you know, push your agenda, you know, in a maybe more aggressive way than some activists were comfortable. In this particular case, really it was just these three men, Darby, Crowder, and McKay, that were involved, and there were more kids that all drove up together, but really the three of them were close and the three of them were discussing what tactics might be useful at the Republican National Convention.
How long before this and why did Darby, who'd been a committed activist, become a government informant?
Well, the jury is out on when exactly he became an informant. The party line or the official line is that he became an informant before this case with David and Brad in the case of a gentleman, a Palestinian activist named Riyad Hamad, who, according to Darby and the FBI, was involved in illegal activity with the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And he started working that case. And shortly thereafter, Riyad Hamad wound up bound and gagged in Lady Bird Lake in Austin, dead, and it was ruled a suicide. I think that's taken on its own life of conspiracy. But there are plenty of activists who think that Darby's work as an informant extended back before Riyad Hamad informing on Common Ground. And several people think that he might have never been a, quote, real activist, that he may have always been working for the government. Kelly and I just don't know the truth. I mean, we've had thoughts one way or the other at different times, but it's all basically hearsay and nothing is clear.
We have a lot of footage of him speaking before people. Was he having himself filmed?
You know, he was a spokesperson for Common Ground. So he really was out in front of the media as part of his mission for Common Ground to raise awareness about what was really happening in the aftermath of Katrina.
Now, are there any suspicions about Common Ground being related to the government, or is that a totally separate situation?
I've never heard that. I think, you know, what we know is that when Brandon got involved in activism, that he sort of moved up the chain in terms of powerful and activists with histories of doing a lot of work and having deep, long histories. And so that's what makes some people suspicious. He got involved with Scott Crow, who was profiled on the cover of the New York Times several months back as an anarchist activist in Austin that the FBI had been following for years. He was involved quickly with Robert King Wilkerson of the Angola 3 and the Black Panthers and Malik Rahim. Those people held him very close. They trusted him, and when word came out that he was an informant initially, they said it absolutely couldn't be true, that it was impossible. But in the end, everybody knew that it was true. Brandon confessed to it in an open letter to the activist community. No one has ever suggested that anyone else within that organization was an informant.
My guests are Kelly Duane de la Vega and Katie Galloway, who have created a film called Better This World, which premieres a week from today at 10 p.m. as part of the PBS POV series. Let's talk about that title, Better This World. Did that come from anything that Crowder and McKay said they were trying to do?
You know, it actually came from what Brandon Darby said he was trying to do in the open letter. He said his mission is to better this world. And we thought it was an interesting title because, in fact, everybody sort of stated mission, or every main character was to better this world. McKay and Crowder, the FBI agents, and the prosecutor, the defense attorney, and Brandon Darby himself.
Both Crowder and McKay say that they're proud to be Americans, and when they're questioned, they deny being anarchists. Do you think that they are?
I think that Brad, very early on before our story takes place, sort of loosely ideologically affiliated with anarchists, but I think both he and Scott Crowe and other anarchists think that the general public has a misconception of anarchy as they relate to it, which is that it's not black-clad and you know, break windows and bring the government down, but rather a non-hierarchical collective action and collective form of organizing, largely community-based. David certainly didn't ever affiliate as an anarchist. I mean, they wore face coverings and black clothing in the protest, but it wasn't to suggest that they were affiliated with anarchists. I think they didn't feel that way at the time.
Go ahead.
I would just say I do think they both did feel proud to be American and sort of idealize the idea that as Americans we can protest our government and speak out, and that's you do that because you love your country and you feel a responsibility.
And they certainly didn't go up there with the intention to build Molotov cocktails. I think we don't want to give away too much here, but I don't want your listeners to think that they thought that the way to protest initially was to throw Molotov cocktails. It was a whole constellation of events that came to a head. That's the sort of central mystery that we wanted to unpack with this film. What happened in the 6 months, 7 months between the time that they met Brandon Darby at that bookstore while he was working as an informant and the moment at which they were arrested and charged with domestic terrorism? We wanted to have an opportunity to look behind the headlines, because there are so many cases like this where there's a charge of domestic terrorism and then a counter-allegation by the defense of entrapment or at least serious misconduct by a government agent or informant. So we wanted to see what happened here.
Well, your film seems to suggest that Brandon Darby, the FBI and police, and the police manipulated McKay and Crowder into becoming terrorists. In Brandon Darby's case, he kind of suggested that a willingness to do violence is what separates the men from the boys.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what our film does is sort of push the sort of, I mean, I think we grapple with the morality of the young men, and I think they, you know, clearly crossed a line, and that is definitely acknowledged in the film. But it also, you know, our hope was to bring into focus several issues related to the government's domestic counterterrorism program and sort of the growing surveillance culture, the criminalization of dissent, and sort of this tension between our civil liberties and, you know, our desire to be safe. And if we are putting a lot of time and effort into this, you know, into rooting out domestic terrorists, I think, you know, most, if not all, Americans are very, you know, in favor of that. But we have to make sure that the tactics in which our government is doing that is, in fact, making us safer. And we sort of explore how far is too far in this film.
What does it mean that St. Paul was designated a Homeland Security site during that weekend?
It meant that, and one of the FBI agents we interviewed talks about this in the film, that 2 years before, once it was designated a Homeland Security site, 2 years before the convention, that the Joint Terrorism Task Force, that a lot of different federal agencies start preparing for the convention. And as he says in the film, E.K. Wilson, we had to run with the idea that there was 100% chance of there being a domestic terrorist attack. And what that meant was, here a few examples are $1.2 million for surveillance cameras to be installed around the Twin Cities. It meant the fanning out of informants across the country to infiltrate activist groups and try to understand what potential threats there were to the RNC. And it meant, you know, billions of dollars spent in preparation for this one weekend.
Weren't there hundreds of arrests?
There were.
Did any of those arrests end up with cases like Crowder and McKay's?
Interestingly, there's only one other arrest that was similar to theirs, which was another Molotov cocktail case, and it also involved a young man who was close to an informant, and I think that young man had sort of a more complicated history than Brad and David prior to his relationship with that informant.
Well, you mentioned the case was made that this was entrapment. How well does that go over with judges and juries these days?
It's interesting. I mean, entrapment cases are notoriously difficult to prove. The federal conviction rate is already easily 90% plus. So the odds stacked against a federal defendant bringing an entrapment case are, massive. That said, there are different definitions of entrapment within the legal system. It's kind of a slippery term, and the judge, depending on the judge, can decide to introduce one or another definition of entrapment. There's one that I believe, after having gone through this case over the 2 years, seems to make the most sense to me, and I would guess that it probably makes the most sense to lay people, which is, had the person accused of the crime never met the government agent or informant with whom they spent time, would they have committed the crime of which they're charged?
What happens to somebody like Brandon Darby? Is most of his adult life has been involved in activism, and now he's exposed as the equivalent of a double agent. Can he just move on to a different kind of a life?
Well, interestingly, he is still an activist, but he's an activist for the right wing. So he's close with Breitbart. He has a column in biggovernment.com. In our film, we play a clip of him on the G. Gordon Liddy show. So he has his politics have shifted, but he's still out there sort of talking about, you know, the issues of our time.
Just one more thing. You have incredible access to surveillance tapes, to all sorts of interrogation tapes. Did the government give that all up to you willingly?
That was a byproduct largely of there having been a federal trial, so many of those elements were part of discovery. We had the FBI interrogation. We had phone calls between the defendants and their families. But in addition to that, we had this incredible wealth of footage from the Homeland Security grant for cameras. I think I said $1.2 million given. And so we were able to access that archive, paid for with taxpayer dollars, and find our characters on the streets of Minneapolis during key events. So that was another big piece of how we wove the backstory together.
Kelly Duane de la Vega and Katie Galloway's film, Better This World, premieres a week from today, 10 p.m., as part of the PBS POV series. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you
so much.
Pleasure.
Wonderful to be here.